So we're going to probably be concluding our lesson this morning in Daniel chapter 1, and we'll probably move into chapter 2. If not, we'll definitely begin that. We may have some opening remarks. That's chapter 2, the book of Daniel, is a very significant chapter in the Bible, and we'll find out why when we get over there and we begin to study. It's a relatively long chapter. It's about 49 verses, so I'm not quite sure if I'm going to break it into parts and hand out questions for about half of it, or if we just try to take it all at once. So I may try to kind of break that up a little bit so that we can focus on specific aspects of that. But we're going to be looking at Daniel 2 probably beginning next week and may have a little bit to say about that because I think we're going to be able to make it through chapter 1 this week. But we left Daniel and his friends in chapter 1 in somewhat of a dilemma, if you'll remember. They are there in the land of Babylonia, and they're being trained, they're being taught, being instructed in the language of the Chaldeans regarding preparation for standing before King Nebuchadnezzar in service to him. So Daniel and his friends were some of the Babylonian or the Jewish nobles that were taken from Jerusalem whenever Nebuchadnezzar first invaded, and he took them back to Babylonia. He said, let's take some of the sharper, the better looking, the nobles. We'll bring them back, we're going to bring them up, we're going to teach them our ways, and we're going to incorporate them into service for the great country of Babylon. So Daniel and some of his friends and some of the other Jewish nobles were taken over there. And immediately they find themselves in somewhat of a predicament. You'll remember that the king has this diet that he's having them fed. We don't know what it is, but it's meat from the king's table, as it's referred to, and it's wine from the king's table. So we talked a little bit last week about the predicament that that was to Jews who had dietary regulations and violations, things that they could not eat. And for a couple of reasons, whether it may be one, food that was unclean for a Jew to eat, that Daniel and his friends are going to reject the king's fare, or possibly because it was meat that may have been offered to idols, and they didn't want to give offense to God by eating the meat that had been offered to idols. It could have been for either one of those reasons. The Bible doesn't specify. But for whatever reason, Daniel and his friends make the objection of eating this food. And they go to the chief of eunuchs, and they make this request, you know, can we change our diet, essentially? And he says, it's not worth me risking my life to change your diet. So they're turned down on the first go-around. They then go, and Daniel appeals to the steward, that one who is more directly involved with the overseeing of his food and of his training and his education. And he makes a second appeal. And he kind of modifies the request. You remember he said, you know, let us eat these vegetables and let us drink water for 10 days. And after 10 days' time, you can compare where we are and compare our appearance to that of the others who've been eating the king's food, the king's meat and wine. And we'll see if there's any serious change. And if there's any degrading and we look worse than they do, then we'll go back and we'll eat the king's food. So he's essentially putting this in God's hand to take care of. So let's read a few verses just to kind of catch up, and we'll begin our discussion, I believe, in verses 13 and 14. So this is where Daniel makes his request. He said to the steward, whom the chief of eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, that's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their Jewish names, as Daniel refers to them. They say, please test your servants for 10 days, and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you, and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. So he's essentially placing this in God's hands. He's done everything that he can to avoid eating this food. And he essentially says, give us a test and do with us then as you see fit. And we'll begin our study right here, verse 14 and 15. So he being the steward who was placed over their food, he consented with them in this matter and he tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. So along the way, any comments, any questions will definitely be welcome, as the content for the remainder verses of the chapter aren't as rich in depth as some of the others that we've looked at, so we'll probably move through these kind of quickly. So we see here the steward consents with Daniel and his friends for this request. He tests them 10 days, and it's no surprise. You know, because we've seen God's involvement in the book of Daniel so far. It was Daniel who gave King Jehoiakim into the hand of the Babylonians. It was God who, in verse 9, we're told, brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of eunuchs. So you see God's hand heavily in the book of Daniel, and once again, Daniel has placed his well-being in the hands of God. And so it's no surprise whenever this request is made to the chief, the steward, that they be allowed to change their diet so they don't eat this offensive food. He looks at them, their appearance in contrast to those who were eating the king's wine, eating the king's meat, drinking the king's wine, and he said they appeared healthier, they appeared fairer, they appeared fatter. And so the steward is thus true to his word, and he continues to allow Daniel and his friends to consume this requested diet. That is the vegetables, the fruit, the grains that they probably consumed, and the water. So we see that once in God's hands, God came through. God heard Daniel. He heard this request, this desire to serve him. And bringing them into the favor of the steward, Daniel's request was heard. Daniel and his appearance appeared better than those who had eaten the king's food. Verse 16 goes on to tell us the steward then took away the portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink, and he gave them vegetables. So, once again, you see God's hand in it. From the reading of this verse, it appears that while they were, this test was taking place, the eating of this vegetables and the water, he was still putting the meat and he was still putting the wine before them because he didn't want to get in any trouble with the king. He wanted to make sure that they were being given what they were supposed to be given by the order of the king. And so during the test this time, that food was still placed before them. After the 10 days, the examination and the comparison is made. He sees they're healthier. They're better looking. So he says, okay, we'll give in to this request. And he removes the wine and the meat that was being placed before them. Yes. What do you think? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but yeah, I did find it kind of odd as I was reading through this, and granted, you know, today science will allow us to see that a diet that consists more of fruits and vegetables and water versus all of the other stuff, especially fatty meats and perhaps the high content alcoholic wine, higher content alcoholic wine that they would have had, then it is going to have a more positive effect on your body regarding your health. But what does it look like King Nebuchadnezzar is looking here for? The food is to make them, let's see, fatter, and they appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. So in regard to that, I didn't actually look into that word to find out what that meant, if it meant that they maintained a healthy weight, or if it just maybe their physical appearance, their physique, if they were perhaps leaner. You know, I'm not sure exactly what that was. I would think that eating meat and drinking wine would make one fatter than if they ate vegetables and water. So, you know, but I do agree with you. You know, we can see through the advancements of science today, the effect, the positive effect on the body of those who adhere to a healthier diet of more natural foods. Of course, animal meat's natural as far as I'm concerned. But if you eat vegetables and you eat fruit and you drink water, probably better for your physical body than those who don't adhere to that stricter diet. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Well, we do know God's hand was in it, but, you know, to what degree? It's hard to say. So, I mean, I'm not opposed to looking at it either way. Yeah, we've seen God work providentially in the book, and we're going to see in a few verses, God's going to work miraculously too. And so, you're right that there's an obvious difference in the appearance of Daniel and his friends after 10 days in this change of diet. And that's probably why Daniel made this request in the first place, because, like you say, 10 days isn't just a real long period of time where someone would have a transforming change in their appearance based off of their diet. And so, whatever the case be, whether God was involved providentially or whether God was involved miraculously to bring about this better appearance of Daniel and his friends, you know, I wouldn't disagree with either interpretation. You know, point is, God was involved. They made this request. They put it in God's hands. God works in this instance, whether miraculously, whether providentially, and they appear better by a comparison. And so thus, their diet is kept among them. Anyone else have any thoughts on that? That's kind of interesting, you know. If they look better, but then you don't want to. That caused quite a ruckus. Somebody, if I was there, somebody took away my meat and wine and gave me vegetables and water. Probably have something to say. King Nebuchadnezzar is going to hear about this. We're going to have some problems. And so they weren't requesting it, But yeah, you're right. It's kind of interesting to consider. Why didn't he change everyone's? If it's all about the result, then why didn't he change those other young men that were eating the king's meat and wine and give them vegetables and water? Maybe they, like Daniel and his friends, they would be better in appearance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. That was a request that they made. You say, we're not going to defile ourselves. If you go back to verse 8, Daniel said, he purposed in his heart not to defile himself with the king's meat. So whether it had been offered to idols or whether it had been restricted meat that they couldn't eat as Jews, he said in his mind, we're not going to eat this meat. We're going to drink this wine that's placed before us. And so ultimately, that's what it boils down to. And you're right. It's not a principle of we can look at this and we can determine vegetables and water are thus healthier than meat and wine. That's not the purpose of this being in here for us to make that scientific conclusion. The point of it being Daniel had determined not to eat it because it was going to defile him for one reason or another. And so he makes this request. God hears this request. And whether God works providentially to bring about this change or whether God works miraculously, the change is noticeable. And the steward allows them to continue eating this diet of water and vegetables and those sort of things. Mm-hmm. Okay, right, and I mean God's provided for these young men in interesting ways, and as we do continue on, as we do look at the next verse, I believe what we have here is providential intervention by God, and I think we have divine intervention by God as well. Verse 17: after this request is made, we see that Daniel and his friends, their physical needs were being met, but also God continues to provide for them. These four young men. God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So it's interesting to consider. Once again, I'd like to know, was God working here not among Daniel? We know that his work with Daniel, for Daniel to be able to interpret and understand dreams and their meaning, the significance behind them, we know that that was divine. We know that that was God involved, and we're going to see that in what the writer's doing. Daniel's setting us up, actually, for what's going to take place in chapter 2. Whenever Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, it's going to... Well, this is why Daniel was able to explain it, because God specifically had given Daniel the ability to make known these dreams, to understand them, to interpret them. However, I'd be interested to know, and the Bible doesn't make a distinguish between this, the knowledge and the skill and the literature and the wisdom that he and his friends had among the Babylonians. There's nothing divine about this. This is perhaps their propensity to learn, their knowledge, their general intelligence. It seems like these young men were gifted in that sense as well. Now, once again, whether that was providential, maybe we shouldn't even involve ourselves with that discussion. Whether that was providential or whether that was divine, these young men were blessed intellectually. And we're going to see the degree that they were near the end of the chapter. But that's fine.
And of some of his princes, and then there were at least four of the children of Judah.
Okay.
That's what we got that much. Mm-hmm. We don't know what any of them read, but the king wanted to take that group of people and keep what he, I guess, I assume what he was trying to do is give them better food.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it was a tactical thing. We don't know what they were eating before this started, but we do know that Daniel and them didn't want to eat.
Right. You mean their diet whenever they were back in?
Well, we don't know what they were eating, but we know what they were eating. We know they were eating what God had demanded them to.
Right.
They were in Judah. They'd just been marched into captivity.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know who fed them on the trip, if they tried to feed themselves. We don't know any of that. We just know that,
sure.
That they didn't want to eat what they were eating. Mm-hmm. So it makes me think that they were eating what God told
him
all along.
Sure, I don't disagree with that. It wouldn't make sense for Daniel, you know, from captivity and the march back to Babylonia, because you remember geographically they had a long way to go.
Yeah.
So they were going to have to be sustained by some degree. Yep.
Also, from the march.
Right.
King's portion.
Right. They were eating meat from the king's table. You know, and we looked in, history will tell us, the commoners, even I believe it was Jeconiah, who was the previous king prior to Jehoiakim, he was taken over to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. And there were some records that were found that showed that he'd been given, I think it was, grain and water. And so, you know, Jeconiah, who was king of Judah, previous to Jehoiakim, he was eating like peasants whenever he was over there in the king's captivity in Babylon. So, you know, all of this, and you bring out a good point, Dick, that what Nebuchadnezzar's doing, it's for a purpose. He's obviously a very intelligent man in this position. And since the moment Daniel and his friends have gotten to Babylon, he has tried to indoctrinate them with this Babylonian culture. And so he's changed their names, you'll remember. He's changed their Jewish names to names that are Babylonian in nature, names that worship and praise and give honor to the Babylonian gods rather than the Jewish God. So he's changed their name, he's changed their diet, he's changed everything about their life. He's trying to steer them in the direction. These are young men, you know, impressionable, at a very impressionable age. And so he's changed so much of their life and so many of the things that they're used to for the purpose of helping them make this transformation from Judaism to Babylonia. So that's part of his goal, I think, is, you know, giving them food that the king eats, giving them food that the Babylonians eat. So in part, that's just what he does, goes along with what his plan is, which is to bring these young men up, to make them Babylonians, and to then they might use their talents, their knowledge, their ability in service to the kingdom of Babylon. So, in doing that with the food that he gave them, you know, we see Nebuchadnezzar's indoctrination of these young men. So, any other comments? So, good point there. You ever wondered, why Daniel? You've got here these four young men who stood out, that were Jews, children of the nobles, that were brought back. And my personal understanding of this is that they weren't just the only four young Jews that were marched back from Jerusalem. That there were probably a good number of others that were also brought back. But these are the only four that we have record of. But Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were there. But yet, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego weren't given this ability by God to understand the dreams. Rather, it's Daniel who's singled out. You know, why we can only guess as to why that was, other than that's the way God wanted it to be. Maybe it's because it was Daniel who kind of takes the lead among these young men and says, you know, back in verse 8, we're not going to eat the king's food, we're not going to drink the king's wine. Or whatever reason it may have been. It was all part of God's plan. And so, thus Daniel is the one of the four who not only is given and blessed with wisdom and knowledge and the ability to communicate with these people in their language and understand their literature, but is also given here the understanding of visions and dreams. And we're going to see how that's applied when we get over to chapter 2. Okay. Verses 18 and 19 continuing. At the end of the days of their training, when the king had said that they should be brought in the chief of eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And then the king interviewed them, and among them all, none were found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they served before the king. So, the 3 years, you remember that's how long they had. 3 years of training had come and passed. And after this preparation, after their teaching, after learning this new language, probably Aramaic, which was the formal language, the language of records among the Babylonians, as well as the Akkadian or the Neo-Babylonian, which would be more spoken in common conversation throughout these people. After their instruction in language and literature, these young men are then brought, their time is culminating, they're brought to stand before King Nebuchadnezzar. And they undergo this interview, whatever that means. So he's asking them questions, he's communicating them, he's trying to find out, to what degree are these young men strong, intelligent? How might I best be able to use them in service to the nation of Babylon? And so whatever that interview, that conversation was, probably in the native tongue that they had been taught and that they had been instructive, he interviewed them, he engaged them in this conversation, and it says, not only, this is, they were smarter than all of the other, and they were more able than all of the other young men that were educated and that were brought up, being instructed and given the same education. And we can, once again, we accredit that to God in the previous verse, and we're told gave them knowledge, gave them wisdom. So you see, God brought that about so that they're more able than all of the other young men. But not only that, he goes on to say that there were none that were found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So even those that were already serving in King Nebuchadnezzar's court, Daniel and his friends, so blessed by God, not only outshined their peers, but outshined those that were already there in service to the king regarding the knowledge that they had and regarding the wisdom of the literature and of the Babylonians. So you see God's definite involvement in the life of these young men. And verse 20 goes on to tell us, in all the matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in the realm. So, I jumped ahead of myself. They were smarter not only than their peers and more sharp than their peers, they were also sharper than the ones who were serving the king, these magicians and astrologers. We're going to talk a little bit more about them when we get into chapter 2 and perhaps their role in Babylonian society. And that brings us here to the last verse, which Daniel kind of uses to bring to a conclusion. This is kind of a bookend, if you will. Remember, the first verse says that Jehoiakim was in his third year of, let's turn over there and look. I think Jehoiakim was in his third year of reign, and that's how he introduces us to the time frame from the beginning of the book, and we see here kind of the other end of that, where Daniel's life's going to come to a conclusion. Thus, Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Now, he's not going to make an appearance until much later in the book, because a lot of this book is given within Daniel's time in service to the Babylonians. And King Cyrus was king of the Medes and Persians. So we're going to see the Babylonian Empire fall, and we're going to see the rise of the Medes and the Persians before we see Daniel's life come to a conclusion. Okay. One last thing regarding this, and I was wanting to take some time because I wanted to hear some of the things that you might be able to share. The last question that we had, what are some of, in conclusion, everything we've looked at, what are some of the lessons that can be taken away to Daniel 1? And I know that we've looked at a lot of these along the way, but I'd be interested to hear things that you've taken away from Daniel chapter 1. Application. Things that might enrich our life. Not just this knowledge of Daniel and his friends and what they went through while they were there, but what they can teach us. So we can just open that up for discussion to anyone that would like to comment on that. Dave? Okay. And what are some ways that we could apply that? Okay. Right. Serving God isn't something that can just be done arbitrarily. And unfortunately, I think too many Christians make an attempt to, That may very well summarize their relationship with God, their dedication to God, is that it's just kind of arbitrary. And we've got Daniel here who demonstrates, I think, for us, especially as a young man, a fine example of what it takes for one to serve God. He's faced here with this very insurmountable task of resisting all of the Babylonian immoral influences that it could have on him. That's just a complete antithesis to everything that he's been taught since he was a young man. That's governed his life and has governed the life of his parents. And he finds himself in this completely different place. And the reason he's able to resist that is because, like David's mentioned, he made up his mind. He resolved, he purposed in his heart, whatever happens, I'm going to serve God. And so, we made this point, I think, back in verse 8 a couple weeks ago. But the same needs to go for us today. We don't want to wait till we get to that point in time where, okay, I've got to make a decision. What am I going to do? Am I going to obey God or am I going to listen to my flesh? Am I going to give in to what my body wants to do? And before Daniel ever got to that point, before he was faced with these things, he said, we're going to serve God. And so it is about mental preparation. And it is about resolving. And that needs to be the way that we as Christians live. We need to follow in Daniel's example. To resolve that no matter what I'm going to be faced with, whatever temptations may come my way, I'm going to serve God. And so when we've made up our mind, we just get to that point. We just follow through with it. We just do what we've already decided that we're going to do, rather than doing as we often find ourselves on the fence there at the crossroads of temptation. And we've got to make that decision in the spur of the moment. And oftentimes, because we've not prepared ourselves and not resolved, we find ourselves making the wrong decision and we have to then deal with the regret and the consequences of choosing to sin. So Daniel kind of shows us how we can avoid all of that by just resolving in our mind that we're going to serve God. What are some other things that were brought out in chapter 1 that you may have noticed that stood out to you? You think parents these days, and I say that by and large, do you think parents these days set the bar too low for children? I mean, as I look at the young people that are coming up, as I look at my generation, my peers, people that are in their mid-20s and late and 30s, as I look at even perhaps a generation back, and the closer you get to the present, the worse it seems to get, that the generation of people and children, especially now that are being brought up, they have somewhat of a sense of entitlement. They think, you know, I deserve all of these things. I deserve all of these blessings. I get out of school. I deserve the great job. And so I'm not going to work short minimum wage and work my way up. I want the $80,000 a year job. And whatever it may be, they were taught that mediocrity is acceptable. They weren't taught self-discipline. There wasn't a work, and I'm speaking in a very general sense. They weren't taught that self-discipline was important. They weren't instilled with the work ethic. And you know, as Robert said, those things are important. And I think that parents today in the world, and I'm concerned some parents even in the church, they just set the bar too low for their children. You need to be understanding. You need to be wise. You need to have discernment. You don't want to set impossible goals. But at the same time, you don't want to set the bar so low that there's no expectation and that there's no growth. In fact, if you look at Daniel and his friends, we estimated that they were 14 years old when they entered into service to King Nebuchadnezzar. And they entered into training. And this Daniel that we're talking about here in verse 1, the purpose in his heart to serve God, he resolved in his heart to serve God, 14 probably to 16 years old. And would we expect today of our children, if a similar circumstance were to come along, we'd say, oh, they're only 14. They're 16. What would you expect of them? They're not mature. They're not experienced. They haven't been through the fire and their faith's been established. I think we'd probably make a lot of excuses. But yet, these young men here resolved to serve God at the risk of losing their life. And so we see here, you do need to instill those within young people. And the only way for them to grow to that point of maturity is that you have those expectations. You set that you involve that training when they're young. Dave and then Johnny.
I only knew them before this.
Okay. Right, and it would have been challenging for any one of these individuals to stand up on their own and to say, you know, I'm not going to eat the king's meat. But just to know that even though there weren't a lot of them, there were four, I'm not alone. And so Daniel, whether he knew them beforehand or whether he met them on the march back to Babylon, he found that he had kindred spirits, people who were faithful and people who wanted to serve God. And so that's who Daniel involves himself with. And through their mutual strength, they resist the ordinance of the king, and they remain faithful, and they keep their promise to God to serve him, to worship no other gods, not to defile themselves with things that God said that they weren't to eat. So the power of those four young men, was, I'm sure they relied on the mutual strength that they had together. Good point. Miss Johnny? No doubt. Right. And you know, Revelation 21:8 says that cowards are going to be condemned. And you know, I don't think that we talk about courage, but we don't talk about it necessarily as a virtue, and perhaps we should. It takes courage for us to fulfill our responsibility as Christians. And you take that in any application, whether it's the courage to go against the grain and swim against the grain of society that says certain things are morally acceptable, and to make a public statement or to say to someone, I don't think that that's the way things are. That's right. Right. I mean, being a Christian, we're told that's going against the grain. And you know, Jesus says all, or Paul says, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus are going to be persecuted. And that's not an if. That's a fact of the matter. Right. And when you walk that narrow way, you're going to face oppression and you're going to face persecution from those who are walking the broad way. And we're going to see that very thing happening to, as Miss Johnny said, we're going to see them, that happened to these young men here as their time progresses in the city of Babylon. But their courage is definitely admirable. Their faith is admirable. And they do everything they can, and it gets to a point where they just have to ultimately, this is going to have to rest in God's hands. And there may be times in our life where we just have to say, you know, I've done everything I can. I just got to give it up to God. I've just got to trust in God to see me through and to do what He's promised to do, which is to preserve the faith. We mentioned last week, that may not always be in the manner that we expect or the manner that we want, but God has promised and God will be faithful. And that's what we see here in the case of Daniel and his friends, is God's deliverance. And it's a lesson for us today just as much as it is for these young men here. Okay. Our time's up. Any other comments or questions that anyone would like to bring out? Okay. We're not told that they were afraid, but you know they were. They're 14, 15, 16-year-old young men that are swimming against the grain to serve God, and their life is on the line. We find ourselves facing fear whenever so much less, you know, we face oppression to so much less of a degree. So you know that they were afraid, but you also know that their faith in God gave them courage to do the right thing. And so they're an example for us today in the life that we live. So I appreciate everyone's participation and comments and the enriching of our Bible study this morning.